And now, The Federal Drive with Tom Temin, sponsored by GEHA.
Hello, and thanks for joining us on this Tuesday, May 7th, 2024, 7 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Temin. Our producers are Eric White and Peter Masurlian. Our digital editors, Daisy Thornton, Michelle Sandiford, and Darris Lauderdale. Coming up in this hour of The Federal Drive, a university creates an artificial intelligence institute, partly to help the government. Plus, NAVSUP works overtime to keep up with the Navy's heightened tempo. Those stories and much more ahead during this hour of The Federal Drive. But first, most Air Force National Guard members performing space missions would retire before moving to the Space Force itself, or at least be retrained for Air Force stuff. But Air Force senior officials insist that moving the National Guard space units to the Space Force is the best path forward. Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis has more. And it sounds like the old Tarryton cigarette ads, they'd rather fight than switch here. What's the response to the possibility of being moved to the Space Force?
The Air National Guard recently conducted two surveys. One went out to the Colorado National Guard, and one went out to all seven states where about 1,000 guardsmen work on space-related missions. And the survey shows that up to 86% of all space professionals do not want to move to the Space Force. And they said that they would retire or they would just retrain for different missions rather than move to an active service branch. So, for example, Hawaii, they have two electromagnetic warfare squadrons, and there are about 90 airmen involved in those space missions. And most of them said that they would rather stay in Hawaii and they would rather be in the Hawaii National Guard instead of going to an active component. We talked to 10 guardsmen who serve in different states, and they cite a lot of reasons why they wouldn't want to move to the Space Force. But let's take a listen to Captain Bonfranks. He's part of the Colorado Guard's 138th Electromagnetic Warfare Squadron, about his experience being part of the National Guard.
Some of the major concerns that stand out, right, are the lack of a path for folks like me that have a regular civilian job that we attend, and then the lack of a clear path for part-time service members in the Space Force as well is a concern. But I think the bigger picture comes to me. I was on active duty in the early 2010s, and there was a pretty significant fire, the Waldo Canyon Fire in Colorado Springs. And on active duty, we were doing a lot of kind of like makeshift firefighter training so that we could go help. But the red tape process for us to become able to go help the firefighters with that natural disaster, it ended up being too much. And so we went through all this training and weren't able to do, I mean, really anything for a very devastating fire. And now I think about my time working with the Guard, and a lot of my coworkers facilitated the COVID-19 pandemic, and folks that I went to college with are out in Omaha and Lincoln, Nebraska, responding to those tornadoes that occurred out there. So I think that for me, it's a much more involved role in the community, and that's, I think, a distinct advantage that the Guard brings that would be very absent with the Space Force.
And here is First Lieutenant Mao Lafitte of the 150th Electromagnetic Warfare Squadron in Hawaii.
I love staying home in Hawaii. I love all the people that I work with. The institutional knowledge that the Guard provides, that's just such a wealth in huge amounts of information and knowledge that gets passed on. So I love being here. I don't want to leave. And just the uncertainty and the ability to possibly be switched, because we are an operational squadron, I'm kind of in a tactical role, and the uncertainty of being maybe moved to who knows what they may be is cause for concern.
Well, I guess he hasn't seen Trenton, New Jersey. But given this reaction among the guardsmen, what do the Air National Guard officials themselves say?
They're saying that moving National Guard space units into the Space Force is, and I quote, a solution looking for a problem. Because the way the DoD is trying to do this move is first by bypassing existing law that requires the federal government to obtain governor's consent prior to making any changes to the National Guard units. So they're trying to get rid of the law before making the transfer. A couple of weeks ago, Air Force Secretary Frank Kendall said that this is a very unique situation, and it wouldn't set a blueprint for pulling more resources out of the National Guard, and that it wouldn't require anyone to move out of their estates. But Air National Guard leaders are saying that nothing legislatively ever happens once. Here's Colonel Michael Griesbaum, the commander of the Alaska Air National Guard's 168th Wing, talking about the legislative proposal.
If LP-480 is successful, it will open the door to a wholesale harvesting of National Guard resources, both from the Air National Guard and the Army National Guard, to the regular components. there is no mission failure that Space Force can point to that would lead us to the conclusion that LP-480 is necessary in any way at all. Air National Guard members have been performing this mission for a generation, for 20 years. They've been doing it faithfully, they've been doing it well, and they have served their nation. LP-480 represents a betrayal of their commitment.
Also, let's take a listen to Brigadier General Michael Bruno, the Director of Joint Staff for the Colorado National Guard, and his response to the Secretary's remarks.
So the Secretary of the Air Force may not move the Space Force unit, equipment, or billets associated with the covered space functions out of the affected state until the Secretary of the Air Force has notified the Congressional Defense Committees of the details of such a move and provided an explanation regarding why the move is necessary to support the defense strategy, and a period of 120 days has elapsed after the notification has been received by those committees. So the current Secretary of the Air Force has said he's not planning on moving them, but the way the LP is written, future Secretaries of the Air Force absolutely can go in there, provide 120 days notification, and then move those units out of the state.
And of course, the states themselves, the governors, have an interest in what happens to the National Guards. They're the ones that can deploy them. Any reaction from states yet, Anastasia?
At first, only a couple of governors came out and said that they strongly opposed the legislation. But last week, the governors of 48 states and 5 territories sent a letter to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin calling for the immediate discontinuation of this legislative proposal. So while there has been a backlash, Air Force senior leaders were on the Hill a couple of weeks ago during budget hearings, and they were pretty clear that that's the best path forward. Kendall said that they want to bring guardsmen under the Space Force Personnel Management Act, and he said that this move would not set a blueprint for pulling more resources out of the National Guard. Let's take a listen to what Secretary Kendall has to say.
We're very grateful that this committee and your colleagues on the other side of the Hill supported the Space Force Personnel Management Act. It allows the Space Force to have full-time and part-time people in it and to be very flexible in how it manages people. So we want to bring these guard units into that same structure. And that's clearly, from the point of view of the Space Force, the best solution. There's no intention to move anyone. So there's some concerns out there that I think are overblown. People will basically have stability if they transition.
But those that disagree want legislation preventing the moves. Fair to say, Anastasia.
And that's fair to say, yes.
Federal News Network's Anastasia Obis, thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And be sure to check out her story at federalnewsnetwork.com. Still to come, the Navy Supply Command works overtime to keep up with the Navy's heightened tempo. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The Navy runs on ships and people, and they need fuel, ammo, and tons of other stuff. Well, now ships are on duty around the world and some on heightened alert because of the world situation. It all highlights the importance of supplies and the supply chain. We get an update now from the Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command, Kurt Wendelken. Mr. Wendelken, good to have you back.
Hey, great to be back with you, Tom.
And there is a lot going on around the world. Tell us what the top concerns are now for the Navy relative to, say, a year ago or 2 years ago.
Yeah, well, obviously the events in the Red Sea have become front and center for the Navy. There's lots of naval activity in that space. I don't think that was really on anybody's bingo card for 2024, but that's where we are. And we're supporting the fleet and a lot of allied partners engaging in those operations in the Red Sea. And we're still continuing with preparations to make sure we're ready in the Pacific. And then more broadly, NAVSUP's been working a supply chain transformation program for the last 5 years, and we're continuing forward with that as well.
And on the Red Sea, I mean, there have been dangers to shipping. And I guess before we get to the specific question there for the Navy, I was wondering, in all the years we've spoken, how does the Navy get stuff around? Is it strictly on Navy vessels, or do you use commercial vessels, maritime, or how does it work?
It's really a mix of lots of cooperation between standard road trucking, right? A really important part of our supply chain is moving material out of depots. They also could go by aircraft. And then ultimately, they're going to end up on a ship at some point. and then get delivered to the Navy. So it could go on a commercial ship to a certain point. We work with Transcom as a provider of either government airlift or commercial airlift. And then what we refer to as the last tactical mile is typically done by the Navy, either by a Navy aircraft or a Navy ship will do the last tactical mile to support Navy vessels that are underway.
So just the sheer movement itself sounds like a pretty heavy logistical exercise.
It really is amazing. We sort of take it for granted because it works so well, but it only works so well because there's so many amazing people, both in the private sector and working for the government, that are making that a success.
So from depots, there might even be overseas depots.
Absolutely. And it varies by what kinds of material we're moving. But yeah, it could definitely be overseas depots where material's coming from.
And just another detail question, do things get delivered to ships at sea?
They absolutely get delivered to ships at sea, what's referred to as UNREP or underway replenishment, where another ship will come alongside the ship and they will refuel the ship while the ship is moving. And then also very often material will be brought over by helicopter while the two ships are refueling to bring stuff like food and parts and other things like that. So we absolutely get resupplied while we're underway.
Well, I've learned something. I thought only aerial refueling was the way things moving got refueled
in
the military.
And again, for people who are interested, I direct you to YouTube to go see some amazing videos of Navy ships getting refueled at sea.
All right. I'm going to take a look at that because my feeds do show the aircraft being done and flying that boom down into that little tiny nozzle there. So the Red Sea, what are some of the specific effects or things you're watching for right now?
You know, we're making sure that the vessels that are operating in the Red Sea have all the material that they need. And it's sort of a challenge because that's not a place where we've traditionally operated in this way for as long as I've been working with the Navy, which has been for over 30 years. So what happens is when a new area of operations opens up, then all the logisticians have to figure out, how are we getting material there? What new ways do we have to use to get our material there? What are the ports that we can use? What are the airports that we can use? And then what are the challenges of getting material to ships while they're engaged in operation? So again, I think that's a novel space that we traditionally have not resupplied in, that we've had to flex our muscles. And I think both the Navy and our joint partners like the Defense Logistics Agency have been rising to the challenge.
What's the old saying? Amateurs plan battle strategies, professionals plan logistics.
It's absolutely true, right? I hate to advertise for myself, but yeah, I think that is absolutely true.
And the South China Sea, that's been troublesome, you know, if you're the Philippines and there's been actual shooting, you know, and so forth and boardings and this kind of thing. The United States has a huge strategic interest there, the pivot to the Pacific and the whole nine yards. What's the situation there? What are some of the challenges?
So I think that's an area where we do operate traditionally. So we have more structure there to support us. But we're really taking a look to make sure that we have everything that we need in place should something occur there that requires the Navy to respond on behalf of the nation.
And what about the commercial partners that you might use in areas that are semi-contested or temporarily contested? Does that take cajoling to have them go there, or probably they have to go to the same places for their other customers?
I think it requires a slightly different way of thinking, but typically, you know, our commercial partners have been alongside with us. The last tactical mile might be the last tactical 100 miles or 500 miles, where material will get moved on to a Navy vessel or aircraft earlier to make sure we can bring that material in without placing people in undue danger.
We're speaking with Kurt Wendelken. He is the Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command. And just a couple of detail questions while we have you getting to the supply chain itself. I just read recently that you have standardized contract language for logistical purposes, and I didn't realize that was a thing. Tell us about that initiative.
So that's part of our own internal supply chain transformation. One of the things that we really recognized as we started better conversations with our suppliers is that we had to learn to become better customers ourselves. So we discovered that some of our contracts missed some of the configuration management language that we really needed in there. And we've been cleaning up those contracts to make it easier for our suppliers to come in and do what are called requests for variances. So if there was something that needed to be changed in how we wrote the contract, we needed to make sure that we had the language in there so they knew exactly what to do. And we didn't always do that. So there's a broader Navy effort called Get Real, Get Better. And this is really us working to get real about things that we weren't doing as well as we could and try to get better. So we had the language in only 17% of our contracts in FY20. In fiscal year 23, we brought that up to 94%. And now we're up to 100% in fiscal year 24. So hats off to our contracting team for taking that critical look at how they were working with our suppliers and making things better.
Well, maybe an example of what type of variance might be called for and what would the language say roughly?
So we would ask for something in the contract. There would be a specification in the contract, and maybe the vendor would come back to us and say, hey, I can't deliver it in exactly that way. I can deliver it in this way, which we think is materially the same. Does the Navy agree? But again, it's administrivia, right? And sometimes bureaucracies get rightly criticized for making the administrivia too hard. But this is really important administrivia and really is part of us becoming a better customer with our suppliers.
In other words, you could get better value and maybe more efficiency, but for contract language.
I couldn't have said it better, right? So it's really a place where the contractor is trying to help the Navy get a better product or get something on a different timeline. And instead of just saying, no, I said it to you one time, just do what I said. It's really a two-way dialogue, which is really the way we should be working with our suppliers.
And I imagine this applies to everything from, say, crates of oranges to capstan or shaft bearings.
It can absolutely apply to everything, right? And I think back to Get Real, Get Better, it really highlights what Navy's trying to do, which is a really important way for Navy to become better and be able to support the nation better.
And you mentioned the supply chain transformation effort. That's one part of it. What are some of the big things this year?
Right now, we're really focusing on our surface combatants, which are destroyers, amphibious ships. It's not always clear to the nation what it is that the Navy does, but I think one of the great things that came out of the Red Sea is the nation has been able to see our Navy in action. So Navy's been on a journey where we started working in the aviation space, our supply chain transformation. We then moved to improve our support to submarines. And now we're working on destroyers to make sure that they have the material that they need on board in the form of spare parts, and that we're really doing as much as we can to support them because, again, they're an important part of what the Navy can do for the nation.
So it's more of an improvement, say, in just in time or in having the resilience if something goes wrong?
So it's really both of those things. And I think, and you and I have talked about this before, COVID kind of showed us where just in time falls down, where, you know, key medical supplies, toilet paper, PPE just wasn't available because businesses had really gone to a just-in-time model. And what we really have to do as a Navy is we have to balance just-in-time with having what we need when we need it. So it's a real challenge to make sure that we're buying the right material. We use mathematical models and AI to help us do that, but we're continuing to improve that because we want to make sure we have exactly the material that the fleet needs when they need it.
Right. So you could almost anticipate needs with the right algorithms and the right data ahead of when they themselves might know.
That's exactly what we want, right? So they have a store of parts on board. So we want to make sure that they're bringing what they need, depending on what part of planet Earth they're traveling to. And then we want to make sure that we're backstopping them with more material ashore in case they need it.
Yeah, it strikes me that because the command of a ship changes regularly and maybe 18 months or whatever, and that captain is gone, NAVSUP knows the whole history of what's been going on in terms of requirements for that given vessel.
Absolutely, right. And that's a really important component for us to be able to forecast correctly. And we work very closely with the engineers at NAVSEA to make sure that we're updating those calculations with the best data that we have.
And a final question, you know, the government has done well on a percentage and dollar basis with small business. But as the Pentagon, you know, writ large has said, the number of participants from small business is going down. There's a million reasons for that. What do you hope to accomplish to get more people attracted to military business and NAVSUP?
That's a great question. The Navy writ large is really, really focused on small business. And we have a number of different programs, including a mentor-protege program, where we take a small business, we would team them with a very large defense OEM, and they would help that small business develop their business with the government. And we all have to remember, every large business started out as a small business. They're really, really critical to both our supply chain at NAVSUP, but to our larger economy in the United States.
Kurt Wendelken is Vice Commander and Executive Director of the Naval Supply Systems Command. As always, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Tom. Have a great day.
And we'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Hear the Federal Drive on demand. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, for contractors, the next few months are all about the numbers. But first, a university creates an artificial intelligence institute, partly to help government. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. The University of Maryland has launched a new institute dedicated to developing the next generation of artificial intelligence people. The Artificial Intelligence Interdisciplinary Institute will support research focusing on responsible and ethical AI across industry and government. For details, Federal News Network's Eric White spoke to the institute's director, Professor Hal Daumet.
Sort of proximally, the institute got started because last summer the provost came to us and said, what would it look like to have an institute that crosses all of campus and, you know, sort of unifies AI everywhere in research and education? And so we had a working group last summer that put together a vision document of what that might look like and what it would take. And, you know, I have to say, somewhat surprisingly, maybe for a public university, you know, less than 6 months later, we actually have an announcement of a new thing. And, you know, I think this is both sort of a sign of the times. You know, this is, I think, a really important topic that lots of people are thinking about. But I also think it's also a signal that our president and provost are really good at moving fast when things are important.
Let me reiterate their question to you. What would it look like? And what is this institute going to include?
You know, the goal here really is to think about, how do we take AI, which is something that's, you know, I think pretty clearly affecting almost everything these days, and think about it not just sort of from the perspective of like computer science or engineering, which is where it kind of historically has lived, and really think about it from the perspective of both the sort of different career paths that students might take, right? What does it look like to be a journalist in 5 years? What does it look like to be a professor in 5 years? But also like the expertise on campus. And I think one of the reasons this is really important is, I think the big AI challenge that we face over the next 10 years is, how do we figure out how to build AI systems that like reflect human values, that promote the well-being of humanity, that sort of like do good in the world? And, you know, these questions of like, what are human values? Like, what happens to society? I mean, these are questions that like humanists study and social scientists study. These are not traditionally questions that computer scientists study. And so like, if we want to answer these questions, I think it's really essential that, you know, kind of everyone is at the table as an equal player.
So is this institute going to focus more on the ethics of AI use and development rather than the actual creation of it? Or is it going to be a little bit of both?
I think the goal is that it's a little bit of both. You know, I think University of Maryland has had a strength in AI sort of research and development, technology development, whatever you want to call it, for decades. And, you know, so a lot of this is sort of like building on that strength, but also sort of shifting it a little bit so that we're thinking about not just developing technology for the sake of developing technology, which is, I think, how a lot of maybe engineering mindset people think, but really thinking specifically about like, okay, what is the impact of this technology on people? How do I change my practices and change the type of AI system that I develop so that, you know, it's most likely to have like a positive impact on people?
We're speaking with Hal Daumet. He is a computer scientist professor at the University of Maryland and the new director of UMD's AI Institute. We talk a lot about ethical AI. It is a term that has a different meaning, it seems like, to everyone. And yeah, as you just mentioned, you know, in the past, it did seem whenever a new technology came along, it was, let's just create it, let's put it out there and let the chips fall where they may, and we'll see what happens. Do you see AI as being different because of the magnitude of what its impact could be?
Yeah, I think one of the things that makes AI different, and I guess when I say AI, I really mean sort of like data-driven either decision-making or generation of, say, documents or images or something like that, right? So the data-driven, I think, is the key here. And I think what we're seeing increasingly is that data is available in a huge wide variety of domains now, which means that the potential for applying sort of this single technology to a wide variety of domains has now become like a practicality, whereas previous approaches to AI that were maybe not data-driven didn't really have that potential to be broadly applied.
It just seems as if, you know, for the first time, the folks who actually are responsible for inventing it and getting it out there for consumer use seem to be the ones that are the most hesitant to say, okay, let's just, you know, take a pause here for a second, whereas usually that's not the case, at least from what I've seen as far as, you know, just covering technology. But I didn't know if that was maybe what you experience or how you feel about it.
Yeah, I think that what we see in sort of like technology development in general is really this, you know, like you said, we'll push it out, we'll see what happens. And, you know, I think there's a lot of value to this. And I think that, you know, lots of really useful technologies have been developed this way. I think what we're coming to realize is that, like, a key property, I think, of almost any AI system is that it's not going to be perfect. Like, all of these data-driven systems, right, they're sort of doing their best given the data that they've seen in the past. And I think unlike a lot of traditional computer science where, for instance, you can prove that the system I deploy will do X, Y, and Z, nowadays we're in this kind of world where we're like, well, I hope it does X, Y, and Z. And, you know, what we're seeing is that when it doesn't, sometimes the mistakes that it makes, which are often really hard to foresee, can have pretty consequential impacts on people's lives, right? Like, we've seen examples of Medicaid getting withheld that led to a big case in Arkansas. And, you know, we've seen cases of people getting into fist fights over translation errors and, you know, all sorts of things where this property of AI that, you know, it's not exactly unique to AI, but I think AI really brings it to the forefront that, you know, these systems are just not going to be perfect. And so how do we engineer something around that that lets people still use them productively while also taking into account the fact that, you know, yeah, they're going to make mistakes and we need to make sure that those mistakes don't cause, you know, sort of irreparable harm or even, you know, large magnitude harm to people.
Getting back to the Institute, so it sounds as if, you know, you're saying AI is going to be creeping into so many different things that you're not necessarily just looking for the people that are, you know, trying to get into the AI field when they graduate. This could be something for, say, a journalism student or a first year medical student may want to try and get their hands on just to see where exactly the technology lays. Did I make a wrong assumption there?
No, that's exactly right. So at the undergraduate level, I mean, we're planning on rolling out some degree programs on AI. But in some ways, I think that some of the really exciting stuff is on what I'm kind of calling like the path to AI, where the idea is that, you know, pretty much any freshman who shows up on campus, no matter what your major is, should have a breadth of AI related courses that they can take that will help prepare them for their future career, but also for their future time as a student. Right? Because, you know, AI is affecting the lives of students just like it's affecting the lives of normal people or non-students. And, you know, so I think that the real potential here is, you know, how do we build this sort of AI-minded future workforce, both among our current students and then also through like professional certificate programs. So people who are current day nurses or current day journalists or, you know, current day K-12 teachers or something, right, can come and, you know, sort of upskill around AI as it affects their profession.
Yeah, there's nothing normal about being a college student. I can attest to that for sure.
This is true.
So, well, what about the folks that are trying to get into the AI field in particular? Are the jobs that many of the AI, I'll call them apologists, have said that, you know, they'll counterbalance the jobs that are eliminated by AI, are there going to be actual careers there as far as maintaining and just kind of controlling AI rather than actually, you know, doing a job that the AI is actually doing itself?
I think that's a great question. And I'll take a step back, right? Like, when I say that, you know, AI is transforming industries, right, it is also transforming computer science, right? And we see a bunch of tools, you know, I think like GitHub Copilot is probably the one that's most recognized. There was just an announcement a couple of days ago about a new sort of software development oriented AI system, right? And so I think the face of programming itself is changing. And in the same way that we might ask, you know, is there a future career for journalists, just to pick on you? You know, we could also say, is there a future career for programmers? And, you know, I guess I'm an optimist. Like, I think that these jobs will shift and how people will spend their time will shift. But I don't think that the jobs themselves are going anywhere. One way that I think is useful to think about this is that what AI systems are good at automating is tasks. And one person's job is not just one task. Like the easiest example here is self-driving taxis. The taxi driver, they drive, but they also clean the car. They also talk to passengers. They collect fares, right? There's a lot more to this job than just the single task of driving the car. And so I think what we might see is shifting of tasks from some things to others. But I don't think in the short term we're going to be seeing, you know, sort of this large shift of, you know, such and such job doesn't exist anymore.
Hal Dahmey is a computer science professor at the University of Maryland, speaking with Federal News Network's Eric White. You can find this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, for contractors, the next few months are all about the numbers. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Radio, part of the Federal News Network. Welcome back to the Federal Drive with Tom Temin here on Federal News Network. It's that most magical time of the year, appropriations arriving 6 months late for the current fiscal year, and Congress futzing over next year's budget, which will also arrive late. Here with his take on what contractors need to do, federal sales and marketing consultant Larry Allen. And this is becoming routine, but how come it somehow doesn't feel routine or correct?
Tom, I think one of the reasons it doesn't feel routine this year is because we were so late in 2023, 2024, getting the numbers for the fiscal year 2024 that it feels like we didn't get any rest. And that's right, we didn't get any rest. We went from 2024 straight into 2025. So we've already got Congress negotiating top-level spending numbers. We've got House and Senate posturing that could change, ironically, in both chambers after the November elections. We have people who are saying that if you want to increase defense spending, that's fine, but we need to really enforce parity with civilian agency spending. And, of course, that's not going to go over well with all lawmakers. So it's just kind of, I wouldn't say it's Act 1, but it's, you know, Act 2 of the FY25 circus, and it's time to pay attention.
So contractors really have no recourse other than to follow the leads in terms of the solicitations and calls for task orders that they're getting from government customers.
Well, I think there are a couple of things that contractors should do right now, Tom, in preparing for next fiscal year. And that is, this week and last week, we've seen a steady drumbeat of administration officials making their way up to Capitol Hill to talk about their FY25 wish lists. And contractors ought to pay attention to what's on those wish lists, because those have a way of making themselves known during the business season for next year. So, you know, you're starting to track those opportunities that are coming down the pike. The other role for contractors is, look, while agencies are beating a steady path to the Hill, there's no reason why contractors can't. House might have some restrictions on earmarks, the Senate, at least for right now, does not. And whether you're talking about an earmark or just trying to make sure that your program gets funded beyond this year, you know, it's important for your elected officials to understand just what jobs are at stake in their states and districts.
Yes, because the usual processes of, I guess you would call it, meta normality are the staff the senior agency staff are going to Capitol Hill to talk about their programs, and the congressional staff is generally listening and taking notes and so forth. So they're going through the motions.
Oh, they are going through the motions. I think, of course, the big question mark is the November election, Tom. You know, will either party be able to flip the party, the chamber that's held by the other one right now? Will we have both parties in control of one chamber? We just don't know. But you can certainly put a hypothesis out there that says if one chamber does flip, or ironically, if they both do flip party control, then I think there will be a lot of pressure to kick final FY25 spending decisions to the next Congress that doesn't convene until January.
We're speaking with Larry Allen, president of Allen Federal Business Partners. Yeah, so right next January in that election, and things tend to get draggy during election years anyway in terms of federal contracting. And I wanted to ask you about your take on the small business numbers. On the surface, it looks like, wow, government has no problem meeting the small business mandate in terms of percentage of contracts and dollars awarded. But that doesn't really tell the full story of the market, though, does it?
Tom, it really doesn't. While it's great news that the federal government for yet another year exceeded its 23% small business prime contracting goal, and not by a little bit, I think you really need to look beyond the numbers if you expect to be able to meet those goals moving forward. And what I mean by that is there's increased specialization in the federal market. If you look at numbers, the numbers recently put out by Bloomberg Government, they talk about the total small business contractor base dropping by about a third over the last 10 fiscal years. A third. That's 33,000 businesses that have net outflowed, small businesses. So when you're trying to bring in companies that are new to the market, who have innovative technology, you're really not doing that. You're rewarding companies that have the specialized infrastructure put in place that they need to comply with all the government rules and regulations. And for all of the talk about people wanting innovative and new businesses, you know, some of the business meetings I've been in, frankly, particularly at DOD, if they don't know who you are, they can be very reluctant to do business with you because you're not tested, you're not proven. So I think while we made good progress this year, there are definitely some storm clouds on the federal small business contract horizon.
And one of the things that doesn't seem to be measured or monitored is, you know, DOD and a lot of agencies run these challenge competitions to get so-called innovative ideas about this or that. It could be a technology, it could be some business process that the agency has, talent management. And yet, I wonder how many of the people that get those challenge grants and prizes, which are small change, basically, ever translate into full-fledged government contracting.
Right. And, you know, we actually have a name for that, Tom. They call it the Valley of Darkness or the Valley of Death, if you want to get really gloomy about it. You know, the people who start off with the innovative grants, some of them maybe CBER Phase 1 type contracts, and then, you know, do they ever make it into actual full open commercial production? Well, not all of them do. And there's been a lot of discussion about how you help contractors in that situation navigate the Valley of Death, but no real great solutions as of yet.
Right. And everybody in DOD knows about the Valley of Death because they refer to it constantly, but there doesn't seem to be any bridges, or if they are, they're getting hit in the bottom by boats.
Right.
Larry Allen is president of Allen Federal Business Partners. We'll post this interview at federalnewsnetwork.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to the Federal Drive wherever you get your podcasts. A new effort to bring some standardization to federal workforce training is primed to move from the test phase to initial operations. The new approach is called Aspire, All Services Personnel and Institutional Readiness Engine. It seeks to reduce the amount of retraining employees need. For more on Aspire, Federal News Network's executive editor Jason Miller spoke with the research program's manager and associate researcher in the Department of Veterans Affairs National Artificial Intelligence Institute, Tony Bozzi.
One particular individual who used to work with us, who's since moved to the private sector, had to take statistics, I think she said, six different times. twice in college as an undergraduate and a graduate. Then she also had to take it when she joined the Navy, when she became a naval aviator, when she shifted jobs again to the Naval Postgraduate School, when she took a research role at the Naval Postgraduate School. She should not have ever needed to do that. My little anecdote is I transferred universities as an undergraduate. I've got a full page of my transcript that just says non-equal elective transfer credit, right? Which I know I still have the whatever 30 hours towards the degree. But talk about annoying frustration to have taken some very interesting and important and special classes, and now they're kind of just lumped in as a, yeah, you did something, here is some credit for it. So that's generally the idea, but I think it empowers not just personnel movement, but one use case that was given to us by transportation back in the day, which I think is really cool, is this idea of if once the system is stood up, then it also allows us to respond, not just to emerging technologies, but maybe to actual emergencies. You might recall a couple years ago, we had a West Coast shutdown where goods couldn't get into the country because we had a big shortage of intermodal crane operators, right? It was a world without a spire. So the way to fix that problem was to try to hire trained intermodal crane operators from the private sector, which is hard because of pay and location and other issues, or to find people who are willing to train up from scratch, which is great because then you got new people that know the skill, but it takes months to get them trained on something. It would have been super cool if transportation could have just said, oh, forestry's got some crane operators who would usually do logging, but it's not logging season, let's borrow them. Or we've got people who use earth movers and the controls on an earth mover and the safety precautions on an earth mover pretty close to a crane, we can cross-train them. And then we could have got boots on ground to help fix an issue like that much more quickly and much more effectively than is available to us in the status quo. So there's a lot of situations and use cases where a system with shared standards and shared trust and shared definitions, or at least crosswalk definitions for these things, can really help not only the personnel not lose time and credit for training and things like that, and to be more able to be agile within the workforce, but to also allow the government to have the opportunity to move people around if we need to respond to emerging technologies or even true emergencies.
What is Aspire? What's its goals? Give us a little bit of that background.
The general idea is a system that will help us identify gaps in current knowledge and readiness of employees and or assess would-be employees for their knowledge, given the specifics of their rate, role, and agency. And then once we understand what any gaps might be, the system, which is done through a computer adaptive assessment, then the gap analysis is done, also automated. Those, both of those are AIs. And then it automatically populates an individualized learning pathway, also an AI, to help give that person remediation. Or after remediation, it also supports people getting ready for their next position or just exploring curiosities. And then we validate badge and credential. And all the while, there's a nice, robust analytics layer that does reporting up to leadership and senior leadership to help them understand where staffing shortfalls might be or where they can find people quickly to fill an emergent need, perhaps a new technology or an actual emergency natural disaster situation. It is a reasonably newish program. We've kind of slow rolled for a couple of years, but the last year or so, we've really kicked into high gear and have put the pedal to the metal to try to deliver a good system for government to make sure that again, particularly that we don't have any operational shortfalls, to make sure that we can have a properly empowered workforce to do the best we can as well as we can and really get the most out of every taxpayer penny.
Now, this is specifically around data literacy, AI. This is not for every single work role. This is very focused.
It is actually agnostic. We are starting with data science and AI because that is the National Artificial Intelligence Institute is the principal sponsor. Also, the original impetus for what put us on this road towards the system was the realization that medical practitioners and researchers were starting to use AI and that we had hired them because they were good doctors, not necessarily because they were good AI persons. And then obviously it cropped out from there. It is a multi-agency effort. So if other agencies have come online, they've brought in things that they desire. Navy and Air Force were early joiners, also wanted AI, data science, cybersecurity. Other parts of the Air Force are looking at a lot of electronic warfare and things. But the idea is that the system can and will teach certainly hard skills, coding, math, and stuff. But we're also looking at research into soft skills to try to support potential partners like the Treasury Executive Institute, who's concerned about leadership, or Leadership VA, which is concerned about leadership and management. So down the line, it will be something of a panoply.
Walk me through how this works. So you went through, in the broad sense, identify gaps, encourage knowledge readiness, assess employees. Walk me through that process.
The way we envision the system working in, let's call it the primary functional process, is you take a computer adaptive assessment. That assessment is absolutely blind to you. All it knows is that you can successfully interact with a computer. It puts you through, like I said, a computer adaptive assessment. How those work is every question is generated based off your performance in past questions. So it starts you in a middle level question. And then if you do well, the difficulty ramps up. If you do poorly, the difficulty goes down. Most people will get 20 to 30 minutes of testing. There is a way to rocket out the top, though it is hard to do. It's also a way to fall out the bottom. We don't want to waste the time of people who don't need to be tested, and we don't want to make people who can't pass the test suffer. Then, like I said, it figures out, all right, well, if you're supposed to know A, B, C, D, E for your role, based on the testing, I know you know A, B, C, E. So then it's going to populate something that might have a little splash of those things just to keep fluid the educational experience, but it'll mostly focus on D. And then you'll get your lessons. Those lessons are focused on micro and nano learning. We try to make sure that the pathway can be done as quickly and conveniently as possible, both in the sense of you can pick it up, put it down, do it on a computer, do it on a phone, but also that the whole pathway is only a few hours long, not 10, 20, 30 hours or 100 hours or the 1,000 hours that it would take to get a certificate. And that's one to make sure that it's comfortable and easy on the user, but also to go back to that getting the most out of every taxpayer penny situation. Every hour of training multiplied across tens to hundreds of thousands, if not millions of you know, workers in the federal government multiplied by their salary is a ton of money and a ton of time off mission. And you go through those pathways. Like I said, those pathways are individualized. Everybody's is going to look different. Not yet, but when we're done for each lesson, we'll have support so that for each thing, you can watch it or listen to it or read it, whatever's best for you, either as a learner or in the context. And there'll be a couple different versions about how you listen to it, a couple different formats in which you can read it. The delivery of a video will be done through AI-generated avatars, so you can change what your instructor looks like, sounds like, even what language they're speaking, to really make sure we can serve all missions across all agencies, even those that have heavy local staff in other language areas like USAID might or DOD might. Then at the end, we do a test again to make sure you actually learned what you learned. I don't think that anybody in the workforce is dishonest, but self-certification is not a standard on which we should rest our hats. So we do test again. And then there is, like I said, badging and certification to help you carry forward and show others, hey, look, I did this thing. I earned this thing. Now, that said, there are some agencies that want to do things a little bit differently. I'm not going to tell people how to do their business. The system can meet them where they want to do the way they want to do it. But the way that we envisioned it is to start with that blind test and to go through the badging. And I'll take one extra second to emphasize the blindness is an equity thing for me. I take very seriously that there's a lot laden into how one gets a degree and the opportunities they had in the past to maybe have a shiny internship or whatever, or maybe they taught them, had to teach themselves coding in the basement, or maybe they got a really great degree and had really great internships and really knew what they were talking about, but they knew it in the 80s and they haven't read a paper since. Right? So there's a lot of things that could be in the water and a lot of lurking variables that we like to sort out. By having that test, again, be entirely blind and have everybody have to take it to prove what you do or do not know today in actuality.
Tony Bozzi, Research Programs Manager and Associate Researcher in the Department of Veterans Affairs National Artificial Intelligence Institute. To learn more about Aspire, check out Jason Miller's federal report at federalnewsnetwork.com. This is the Federal Drive with Tom Temin. For the latest updates, stay with federalnewsnetwork.com or follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm Tom Temin.